Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and it's time for Between the Covers. We're now at episode 8 of Terence Greene's novel, Shadow of Ashland. It's the story of a man's search for a relative who's been missing for 50 years. Leo Nolan travels from Toronto to Ashland, Kentucky, following a trail of old letters from his uncle Jack. Once there, Leo finds his uncle all right, but Jack is still a young man in his 20s. And without warning, Leo finds himself back in the Depression era, sharing a room with Jack at the Scott Hotel. Down in the basement, a band of desperate men is digging a tunnel under the streets of Ashland. They're planning to rob a nearby bank. Leo pitches in, but now it's begun to rain, and the water in the tunnel is rising fast.
The springs in the tunnel ran in rivulets around our ankles as we dug. Emmett spent most of the night checking and propping the vertical beams, shoring them up where water had eroded the firmness of their footings. He fixed additional horizontals beneath the tram tracks where the earth had begun to disappear. The wetness turned most of the earth into mud, and each shovelful took on 3 times the weight. By dawn, we were exhausted. The water in the pit had risen another 4 inches. At noon, we sat on the veranda of the hotel and listened to the train pull into Ashland. Within an hour, we were able to watch as the armored car pulled up to the bank and began to unload the money. The rain poured down steadily as the gray figures moved from truck to bank and back again. When Jack went to his hospital job that evening, I went into the basement where Stan and George had already begun to work. A small steady stream sluiced noisily down through the tunnel mud into the drain pit. Even from where I stood at the base of the stairs, I could see that the hole was full. Jack came into the tunnel sometime between 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. We were ankle deep in water. As the rain loosened the earth, the far end of the tunnel began to fall away in ever larger chunks under our assault, a phenomenon both exhilarating and frightening. We filled the tram what seemed like 100 times, sending it back to the basement to be dumped. The tracks were completely underwater. As we burrowed deeper under the streets of Ashland, Emmett and Henry cut and built the supports from pine beams, shimmed and jockeyed them into place, fixing them with miner's care, knowing what was at stake. Still, as the water swirled about the bases of the beams, even though nothing was said, the worry in their eyes was clear. And then the light bulb went out. I blinked, its after image still burning into my eyes in the dark. Jesus Christ! What happened? Quiet! A flashlight snapped on. I squinted at the new glow. It was in Stanley's hand, attached by a chain to his belt. The beam moved steadily about our surroundings, focusing finally on the electric wire that ran our lights. There was water dripping from the tunnel ceiling now, and the wire was covered in droplets. Stanley started back along the tunnel. We followed. We lifted our feet carefully so as not to trip on the submerged tracks. The water swirled now at mid-calf, rising. About 40 feet back along the tunnel, we saw what had happened. A small portion of the tunnel roof had collapsed, pulling down with it the electric cord. The wire angled down from in front of us to where it was buried beneath a pile of wet earth some 2 feet high. The earth covered the floor of the tunnel for about 6 feet. We looked at it, looked at one another. Stanley bent forward, pulled the end of the wire. "Hold this," he turned, detached the flashlight and gave it to Jack. Then he crawled up on his knees atop the collapsed earth and pulled the wire loose for the 6 feet it was buried. He stood on the opposite side of the pile, the cord in his hands. "Must have pulled a connection loose farther back." "Ain't good," said George. "Looks like we got some repairs to do," Stanley said. We stared at him, standing in the glow of the beam from Jack's hand, the water building up closer to our knees. It only took minutes to clear most of the fallen earth, to shovel it to the sides enough to uncover the submerged tracks. But instead of disappearing, the water merely dropped a few inches back to the level of mid-calf. We stared at the space in the ceiling above us where the earth had collapsed. I thought of the entire town sitting above us, of our frailty in the earth below. I asked it, what was not being said. "Is this safe?" For a moment, there was only the sound of the droplets falling and the quiet rush of water about our legs. "Mine's a mine," Stanley said. "Tunnel's a tunnel. Ain't natural. Men ain't really supposed to be down here doing this. Always a risk." "But the rain," I said. "The water." Their faces set grimly, in silence. "Out of working shifts from now on," said George. Stanley nodded. "No more than three at a time in the tunnel," he continued. "Make sure there's always more on the outside than on the inside in case another chunk collapses. Could dig us out or get help. Be a safety measure." "Makes sense," said Jimmy. "It'll slow us up," said Emmett. "Digging's going well," said Stan. "Like Jimmy says, makes sense." Emmett looked unconvinced. "Till the rain stops," said Stanley. Emmett hesitated, then nodded. "Makes sense, I guess," he agreed, finally. That evening, after dinner, we sat in the parlor in front of the radio, sipping tea. Myself, Jack, Stanley, Teresa, George, and Jimmy. The teapot sat on a crochet doily on top of a mahogany coffee table. Beside the teapot lay a well-thumbed copy of the February 1934 issue of Vanity Fair, which looked all of its 9 or 10 months old. I sipped my tea. "Where are we in the tunnel?" Stanley looked up. "Right underneath it," he said. "Right under the vault. We'll be through tomorrow." "Drills and torches are ready to go," said Jimmy, speaking for the first time. "What happens when they open the bank on Monday morning and find the money gone? See the hole, the tunnel?" I'm not sure I really believed we'd get there until I asked the question. I realized I'd just been going along with them. Stanley looked at Jack, then at George. They smiled. Then he said, "We think we got it figured out." Jack leaned forward, the blue eyes, the white smile. "Got a series of plans, Leo. None of them lead back here." Teresa listened, quiet, wide-eyed, admiring. Stanley was nodding, thinking. Then he looked from Jack to Teresa, watching. I saw the look on Stanley Matusik's face as he watched the two of them and realized that he knew. As I watched him, his face became a puzzle, his eyes colorless. I watched for anger, resentment, jealousy. Instead, I saw traces of sadness in the slackened muscles, a deep weariness in his carriage. Jack looked at him. "No, you go ahead," said Stan. He seemed suddenly to struggle with the tiredness, to shake it away, collect himself. "You tell it." Jack smiled, excited, oblivious. "Emmett and Henry aren't here, you notice? They're part of another crew. They've been digging a shorter, smaller tunnel that's all set to join up at a right angle with ours just beneath the vault. Only got about 3 more feet to go. Comes in from a sewer main beneath Winchester. We got it filled with clothes and stuff left behind by transients. False trail so they won't be looking for locals. Hundreds of false clues everywhere. Address books, empty wallets with old IDs, road maps with places circled, train schedules, you name it." His eyes shone. "We got the last 20 feet of our own tunnel rigged to collapse, where it meets the Winchester one," he continued. "Pull a couple of ropes, it disappears. They open up Monday morning, see everything cleaned out, see the hole, follow it down to the tunnel that leads into the main sewer, see all the stuff we put there, and that should be it. No reason at all for them to come looking for us. No reason even for any of us to have to leave the hotel or Ashland." "But won't they see the collapsed opening?" The question spilled out of me. "Won't they be able to tell that there was a tunnel there?" "Emmett and Henry will fix that. They can smooth it over between now and Monday morning so as you'd never know there was one there," said George. "If anyone suspected and decided to start digging it out, why, they'd never be able to tell if it was a tunnel or not. And we can fill in and collapse the rest slowly over the next few days. Nothing will lead back here." I didn't have much to say. They seemed to have covered all the bases. Then we heard the thunder. It rumbled down from the east, rattled the windows. The rain continued to bounce off the pavement outside. All the bases except one, I thought. I began to feel lightheaded. The parlor of the Scott Hotel came into focus as though through a wide-angle lens curving at the edges. Is any of this real, I wondered? Will I ever see my father, my home, my job, Jean, or Adam again? Where am I? What's happening? I didn't know. Below us, the Ohio River strove upward, trying to join the sky and the rain, squeezing us blindly in between. "Jack, George, and Jimmy are the first shift," said Stanley. "They should clear the earth right up to beneath the vault, scrape it clean so's we can see what we're doing." For the first time in front of me, Stanley unfolded onto the coffee table atop the Vanity Fair a working diagram of the tunnel, the secondary tunnel, the sewer system, all superimposed on a scale drawing of the streets and buildings. "Leo and I'll work the basement, pull the tram out by a rope if we can, spread the dirt around best we can." "Water's pretty high," said George. "Don't know if you'll be able to move the tram that way. We'll try it anyway. If we can't, we'll do whatever we have to, whatever it takes." In the basement, the water was deeper than we had dreamed. It swirled above our knees, restless with no place to go. "This'll never work," said George. "Too much water." "Has to work," said Jack. He went first into the tunnel. Jimmy followed right behind him, taking his end of the long rope, letting it uncoil like a water snake behind him as he disappeared. George looked at us and then focused on Stan. "Too much water," he said again. "We should wait a month." Stanley's eyes did not see him. They seemed to be following the sound of the men wading down the tunnel. "We're right there," he said, "right under it. It's ours." George looked at me, then back at Stanley. "Rain might even help." Stanley Matusik's eyes glazed. "Make it easier to collapse the tunnel afterward. No sign of any kind. Bury it forever." George heard the same illogic in the voice that I heard and looked to me for support. "Maybe George is right," I said. Stanley did not even look at me. "Too late," he said. "Everything's too late. What's going to happen is going to happen." He stared down the tunnel. George turned and went after Jack and Jimmy. We were able to retrieve the tram with its first load of earth, but when we emptied it, it was clear our system wouldn't work anymore. The water continued to rise, and empty of weight, the tram car became unstable, not light enough to float, not heavy enough to ride the tracks. "They try pulling it back, it'll tip on its side, fill up with water," said Stanley. "I think you're right. Better tell them." He started to wade toward the tunnel. "I'll come with you," I said. I slogged after him. I don't know exactly what happened. I try to replay it in my head, but I can't see it clearly. In my mind, I feel the water around my legs, feel the mud of the walls with my hands as I walk along, squint into the glare of bulbs. Then suddenly it is dark. There is the feel of stale air on my face, blown as with a bellows. Then I hear the muffled splash far up the tunnel. At the same time, I feel the walls shudder under my hand. The water stirs with new bubbles. A wave washes up toward my waist as it surges past me, ricocheting its way into the basement where it will crash around crazily without escape. In the dark, I stand there, knowing that everything has gone bad. The flashlight beam snapped on in Stanley's hand, darting crazily about the walls as he ran ahead of me through the water. I ran after him, tripped, fell, got up, and ran again. The beam of light stopped at the wall of mud in front of us. Jack, George, and Jimmy were in there somewhere, under it or beneath it. I saw Jack's eyes, my mother's eyes, erupt like startling blue flares in my brain, arcing from the past to the present and back to the past. Stanley, Emmett, and Henry and I dug for the next 14 hours straight. We burrowed a narrow path 10 feet into the fallen mud without sensing any end to it. When the water was above our waists, a section of tunnel some dozen feet or so behind us collapsed, leaving only a foot or so of airspace above it. We shone our lights back along its top surface. The collapsed portion was only a 6-foot span, a segment between supports. The trapped water around us was rising rapidly. We turned our efforts on the earth behind us, digging with energy we didn't know we had left, scraping a path along the top of the collapsed mud that would allow us to crawl over it. With water at our chests, we heaved ourselves up and inched our way out of our own plight, sliding down into the water and mud on the other side. In the basement, exhausted, we tried to collect our thoughts. "Have to go back," said Emmett. We looked to Stanley. His face showed nothing. "Can't," he said. "Not now. Too much water." A pause. "We need rest. Food, too." "We can't leave them there," I said. Stanley looked at me. "What about the other tunnel?" I asked. I looked to Emmett and Henry. Henry shook his head. Runs off the sewer, he said. Sewer's full. Everything's flooded. You'd need diving equipment. Even then, full of water like this, whole goddamn thing could come down on you in an eye blink. He looked down the tunnel in front of us. This one, too. What do we do then? I asked. I heard my voice rise a notch. No one answered. The water, thick with its mud and power, flowed relentlessly out of the darkness around us. By Sunday night, the water filled the basement completely.
Michael Hogan, reading from Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. Tomorrow, Leo is back in the present, where he learns from the now elderly Stanley what happened after the tunnel collapsed. To end tonight's reading, I have a poem about water and destruction. Elegy for the South Valley is a meditation on a dam that's fallen into disrepair and the power of nature to reclaim the structures of civilization. It was written by the late Pat Lowther, and it's read by Sherry Flett. Elegy for the South Valley. South Valley Dam is silted up. The slid scree of a whole mountain is leaning there. Some year when the rains keep on and on as they do, it will go. And the winds seethe in the trees, the cedars toss and toss in the creek froth over broken banks, and the work of men will all be undone. We have no centuries. Here a few generations do for antiquity. Logging camps hidden around the backs of mountains, shacks falling without sound, canyons with timber trestles rotting to shreds like broken spider webs, straight scars and planks collapsed on the walls of improbable mountains, 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 and the dam that served a mine, that serviced empire, crumbling slowly deep, deep in the bush. For its time, for this country, it's a pyramid, it's Tenochtitlan, going back to the bush and the rain. The gravel pit is eating South Valley the way you'd eat a stalk of asparagus end to end, saving the tender tip for last. It starts at the highway end, gouging alder and huckleberry off the creek banks. Dust loosed in the air precipitates slowly on water and smooth, wet stones. Each year, the tooth marks go deeper along the valley, higher into the green overhanging falls and terraces of water, shearing toward the head of the South Fork, where the dam leans between time's jaws, waiting for either the weight of its past or the hard bite of the future to bring it down unmade, and original gravel bury its shards at last. Elegy for the South Valley, a poem written by Pat Lowther and read by Sherry Flett. It's from Time Capsule, a collection of Lowther's selected poems published posthumously by Polestar Books. That's our program for this evening, but before we go, I'd like to remind you that the Between the Covers collection of audiobooks is available through Goose Lane Editions. Selected readings from past seasons of the program are available on CD or on cassette. For more information and to order, you can call this number toll-free, 1-888-9-COVERS. That's 1-888-926-8377. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, and then it's time for classical music from CBC Winnipeg on Northern Lights.